There is a whole lot we do not know about the work of spies, and there's obviously a reason for that. If spies worked out in the open, they would not be spies, or probably not very effective ones anyway. Today's guest wrote a book about the late spy and CIA agent Robert Ames. He is the title character in the book The Good Spy. We learn a lot about Ames in the book, much of it about his tireless efforts to pursue real and lasting peace in the Middle East, something which clearly and sadly still eludes us today. Kai Bird is the author. He was born in Eugene a few years ago, or more than a few years ago, and has written several other books, including a couple of other biographies, American Prometheus, a biography of atomic bomb builder J. Robert Oppenheimer, won a Pulitzer Prize for Kai Bird and co-author Martin J. Sherwin in 2006. Kai Bird's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have extensive connections of your own in the Middle East, it would appear. You'd live there, in fact. When and what was the circumstance?
Well, my father, you know, was from Oregon, and I was born in Eugene, but he joined the Foreign Service, and so I grew up as a child throughout the Middle East in places like Jerusalem, Beirut, Saudi Arabia, and Cairo. And so I actually knew Bob Ames, the subject of my biography, The Good Spy, when he was our next-door neighbor in Dahran, Saudi Arabia, and I was like 11, 12, and 13 years old.
But he was already doing his business then? He was already in the game?
Well, that was his first posting abroad as a CIA clandestine officer.
Given what you found out over the years about Robert Ames, was it really just a matter of time, Kai Bird, before you wrote this book?
Oh, no. It's, you know, life is a series of accidents. And, you know, I'm glad I stumbled upon this story because it's just a fabulous story and a window into the world of intelligence. But I did know him. I had, you know, these sort of childhood memories of this tall, handsome, 6'3" guy who was in his late 20s at the time, who loved to play basketball. But I didn't realize at the time, you know, when I was a boy, that he was a CIA officer, a spy. I only learned that later and only really acquired an interest in his life when he was killed in a truck bomb attack on the U.S. Embassy in Beirut in 1983. So it's sort of that story, his story has sort of stuck in my mind all these years. And about 4 years ago, I began to tackle the subject and began, you know, I tracked down his widow and about 40 retired CIA officers and four retired Mossad officers who had known him. And it became just a great story.
Give us the broad sketch at first, if you would, Kai. What is it about Robert Ames that makes him so notable?
Well, he was a good spy. He was very good at his work. He was also just a good and decent man, you know, faithful to his wife and six children and a basketball star in college. And he was a good spy in a way, you know, he was not a James Bond kind of spy. He did have to carry a gun in his belt at times in dangerous places like Aden and Beirut, but he hated guns and he never killed anyone. But he was good at his work, and when I say that, I mean he was good at listening to people. He was empathetic. He loved the Middle East. He learned the history. He learned the language, which is a very difficult language for an English speaker to acquire. And he was good at recruiting people, but better, even better, at making them his friend. And that's why he was a good spy, and he used those talents to form a highly clandestine, very secret back-channel relationship to the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, as early as 1969. And that's really the heart of the story, of his story and his importance.
It seems like we often give credits to the diplomats who make these great breakthroughs in coming up with ceasefires and peace agreements and all that sort of thing. But the fact is, as we learn from this book in particular, it's people like Robert Ames who are sort of the frontline diplomats doing the work behind the scenes when it really isn't supposed to be going on at all.
Right. No, that's exactly right. He went places where a diplomat, a regular Foreign Service officer like my father, for instance, could not go. You know, in the late 60s and 70s, Henry Kissinger, the Nixon's national security advisor and later Secretary of State, had publicly promised the Israelis that we would have no official contacts with the PLO and the Palestinians and their leadership because they were branded as terrorists, using terrorist tactics. And as a result, U.S. diplomats couldn't talk to one of the important players in the Middle East in a very chaotic and dangerous period of time. So this is where someone like Ames could sort of fill the gap. He could go where a diplomat couldn't go. He could reach out and have a clandestine meeting in a cafe in Beirut, which is where and how he first met Ali Hassan Salameh, who was a young 28-year-old Palestinian who was Yasser Arafat's virtual intelligence chief. And initially, Ames was attempting to sort of feel out whether Ali Hassan could be recruited as a paid, fully knowledgeable agent. But he quickly realized that Ali Hassan was sort of unrecruitable, loyal to the Palestinian Revolution and unrecruitable. But Ames proceeded to pursue this relationship and turned it into a friendship.
Which paid some big dividends, not quite as many as he'd hoped ultimately. But we'll get back to the story about Robert Ames, the good spy, as the book is called. Kai Bird is the author and our guest on The Exchange. Back to our discussion with Kai Bird and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kai Bird, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, co-author of American Prometheus, and the author by himself of the book The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. Ames was a CIA operative who firmly believed that peace could be achieved in the Middle East. He died in a terrorist bombing in 1983 at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, but his legacy lives on, and his story is well told in Kai Bird's book. You can join the discussion about Middle East peace and Robert Ames and his part in pursuing that. Our phone number here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. I have a question here about the access to declassified records, but it's more fascinating, I think, to talk about the paper trail you started with, which was a 2003 civil suit filed in U.S. District Court, I understand, Kai.
That's right. Yeah, that was sort of the beginning of my research when I discovered this body of transcripts from a court trial, a civil suit that had been filed by the widow of Bob Ames and other survivors and relatives of the victims of the bombing from 1983. I realized it was, you know, very dramatic testimony, and that it would allow me to at least, at the very least, write a dramatic account of how Bob Ames died in this terrible truck bomb attack. But you know, the research was an odyssey. Let me tell you, it was. I tried to get cooperation from the CIA, and they basically refused to answer my emails. I had one meeting with them, and nothing came of it. But I did find these 40 retired CIA officers who all wanted to talk. They all wanted to tell the story of Robert Ames and what had happened to him. And likewise, I went to Israel and I found 4 retired Mossad agents who had known Ames and interviewed them. And at one point in one of my interviews with a rather high-ranking retired Mossad officer, I was explaining to him what I already knew. And he interrupted me and said, "But is your government going to allow you to publish all these secrets?"
Different kind of story.
But
yeah. That's a good thing to laugh about. Does Mossad is the Israeli equivalent of the CIA?
Exactly.
Okay. I'm curious about the conversations with the 40 CIA officers you did talk to, though, whether there were times when they got quiet on you or said, "No, I can't tell you that."
Yes, there were times when, you know, they would say, "I can't go into that." And initially, I had to promise all of them anonymity. And so I gave them aliases in the first draft of my book. But then as the manuscript was finished, I went back to all of them and said, this is how I'm quoting you, and would it be all right to use your true name? And out of the 40, fully 15 of them decided to use their true names. So, you know, these were sort of old secrets. They were still secrets, but they were 30- and 40-year-old secrets about what the CIA was doing in the Middle East in the late 60s and 70s and 80s. And they thought it was time to have these stories told.
Given how much the CIA stymied your access, were you even able to find out why they wouldn't give you the information?
Oh, the agency is notorious for just being very uncooperative with historians or journalists. You know, it's all classified. Hmm. But, you know, my sources wanted these stories told because from their perspective, it was important for the American people to understand that the role that the CIA played in jump-starting the peace process in the Middle East, you know, which, alas, has reached a stalemate, a tragic stalemate, but it was necessary at some point for the Palestinians to begin talking to American officials and vice versa, and for the Palestinians to begin talking to Israelis. And Bob Ames is the guy who sort of made this happen, starting in 1969 with this relationship with Ali Hassan Salameh, the PLO intelligence chief.
Kai Bird, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. The book actually begins after the end, months after Robert Ames' death. I mean, who was Frank Anderson, and why did he take some people out to Ames' grave in September of 1993?
Well, this was on the day that Yasser Arafat was going to shake hands with Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister. And it was a sort of culmination of many years of secret negotiations, which culminated in what we call the Oslo peace talks. And they were finally signing a peace treaty. And Frank Anderson was a CIA officer who had known Robert Ames and worked with him, and in 1993, he realized that no one had been invited from the CIA to that White House lawn to witness the ceremony, and he thought that was a lapse, and so he ordered up a couple busloads of CIA officers and took them out to Arlington National Cemetery to stand by Ames's gravesite and explain to these younger officers how this Oslo peace process had actually started, had been initiated by this young CIA officer who was just very good at his work, and I think he was trying to instruct them on what they might be able to achieve in the best instances in their own careers by looking at what Ames had done.
And just to bring the timeline back into order here, this is 10 years and then some after Bob Ames died that Frank Anderson took them out there. You've already described him as not James Bond-like. In fact, you do describe him instead as something like a Jimmy Stewart character, which makes the rest of us go, that's a spy?
Yeah, well, exactly. This was a big surprise to me. But, you know, there are sort of James Bond swashbuckling cowboys in the CIA, particularly these days. But you know, that's not what a good spy should be. A good spy should actually be very low-key, behind the scenes, a man who is able to listen and understand a foreign society in a very dangerous neighborhood and make his way and make contacts. And Ames was just, you know, a classic in that way. He was a sort of Jimmy Stewart character. He was very disarming, honest and straightforward. He was obviously an American walking down the streets of Beirut. He often favored cowboy boots, and he was 6'3", so that made him even taller. And he had, you know, crew cut, and he favored aviator style glasses that were tinted pink and blue.
You know, made an impression.
He really stuck out like a sore thumb in Beirut. But people liked him. They liked his disarming honesty and gravitated towards him.
What we haven't talked about is the formative years. What led a person like Bob Ames to take up the spy game? What got him there?
Well, he grew up in Philadelphia. Unlike many of his colleagues in the CIA, he did not go to Harvard and Yale. He was not part of Skull and Bones, the secret society at Yale, which was the case for many of the original sort of CIA officers in the late 40s and 50s. But Ames grew up in Philadelphia, the son of a steel worker. He was the only guy in his family who ever went to college as a basketball scholarship boy. And after 4 years in college, he was drafted in 1956, 57 into the U.S. Army and sent to Cagnew Station, a very isolated U.S. Army signal listening post in the mountains of Ethiopia. And in the streets of Ethiopia, he often heard Arabic speaking, and he sort of, fell in love with the language and the cadence of the language and started teaching Arabic to himself on his own. And when he got out of the Army 2 years later, he applied to the CIA because he wanted to go back to the Middle East. And it was sort of that simple. And at that time, in 1960, when he joined, most young CIA officers were gravitating towards, Russia and the Cold War and the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. But Ames had an interest in the Middle East, and so they assigned him to work on his Arabic and study Middle Eastern politics and sent him to Saudi Arabia on his first posting.
Kai Bird is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, about the CIA operative who you might have never heard of, but he worked very hard for Middle East peace and died for his efforts at the embassy bombing in Beirut in 1983, but at least could point to some accomplishments that moved forward from beyond his time. Join us on the Exchange if you'd like to join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number is 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So he liked the Middle East. He liked the Arabic language. He wanted to go back there, ended up in the CIA. It sounds like friends and family had some questions like the ones that come to the mind of the people who read the book about what Ames was up to. And how did he respond to those?
Oh, well, as a CIA officer, he had six children, but when he died, only the eldest child knew that he was actually a CIA clandestine officer. The rest thought he was a State Department employee. So his work was, secret. And when you're a CIA officer, you're not supposed to tell even your family and friends what you're up to.
And so his wife, Yvonne, apparently didn't know a great deal about what he did, too.
She actually knew that he was employed by the CIA, and he confided in her actually quite a bit. And one of the breakthroughs I had in the research for the book was quite extraordinary. After interviewing Yvonne at length, she eventually found and turned over to me 150 pages of handwritten correspondence that Robert Ames had sent to her during his short trips abroad. And these letters really formed, gave me the biographical information to be able to turn it into a real biography. And he confided in her about his work. So through these letters, you sort of get a real sense of the kind of day-to-day routine of a CIA officer stationed in an embassy abroad, and, how dangerous the work was sometimes, but also how boring it could be and how much writing a CIA officer is asked to do. And it really grounded the book in a reality. It gives you a real sense of what it's like to be a spy.
You do get a sense, too, of Robert Ames himself, that this is a person who really liked people. He was a believer in improving the human condition.
Yes, and it was a real tragedy when he died. By that time, he had risen very high up in the agency. He was an Arabist. He was very sympathetic because he'd spent so many years in this part of the world to the Palestinian perspective and to the plight of the refugees. But he also understood the security dilemmas of the Israelis. And by 1982, he was the chief briefer on anything to do with the Middle East for Ronald Reagan. So he would, when something was happening in the region, he would be called into the Oval Office to brief Ronald Reagan. And Reagan's Secretary of State, George Shultz, came to trust him implicitly. Ames, actually, one of the revelations I write about in the book is that he was the sort of ghostwriter of Ronald Reagan's September 1982 peace initiative, which was the first time the U.S. tried to put on the table its own vision of a sort of two-state solution or something close to a two-state solution for solving this intractable problem between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And when he died in this tragic truck bomb attack, which, we should talk about that briefly at the end, but about who did it. Anyway, when he died, this shocked Reagan and disheartened him, and he never pursued the Reagan peace plan, which would have, among other things, required the Israelis to stop building settlements in the West Bank, which is, of course, one of the serious impediments to finding a two-state solution and a long-term peace plan today.
Let's take a call. We have Bill in Arcata on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Kai Bird about The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames.
Thank you, Jeff. This discussion is so good that if I'm sidetracking it, please just drop my question. But the question is whether there's a connection between Ames and Oppenheimer. And I'll just let you take it from there.
All right. Thanks for that, Bill.
Okay.
So connect the subjects of your books there.
Well, let's see. The only connection, I think, is me. And I as I've explained, Jeffrey, I grew up in the Middle East, and I sort of know the region in an intimate way, but I know it too well. And for years, as a journalist and historian, I tried to stay away from the subject of the Palestinian-Israeli thing because it was such a hot-button issue. I'd rather write about Robert Oppenheimer and the atomic bomb in Hiroshima or the Bundy brothers and the Vietnam War, anything than to have to deal with the Middle East. But finally, after many books and after winning the Pulitzer Prize, I think this gave me courage to tackle this subject of the Middle East because
it's like
so controversial.
Right, like climbing Mount Everest, isn't it?
Right.
Some of the things about Robert Ames and his formation as a spy. I mean, he was at the farm, as you put it, when the Bay of Pigs invasion took place. He was posted overseas during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, the Six-Day War. And did that change his assignment specifically?
Yes, he was actually supposed to go on to another posting after the 67 War, but many Arab countries broke relations, and so he ended up being sent to Beirut for more language training, and this is actually where he began to develop his contacts in the Palestinian community in the late 60s.
Now, Beirut, then, a very different place, called the Paris of the Middle East, wasn't it?
That's right.
What was it that made it so cosmopolitan?
Well, the Middle East in general is sort of a crossroads geographically of peoples and cultures and religions. And this is particularly the case of a place like Beirut, which is a lovely seaside city, which in the late 60s, still had a significant Jewish population, Jewish Lebanese. But it also had many Christians, Maronite Christians, Greek Orthodox, also the whole range of the Islamic community, Shia and Sunni and Alawites and Druze. And it was just a very cosmopolitan place where there were, when I was studying there in university briefly in 1970, I was studying Arabic myself, but I could go off to Rue Hamra down a few blocks away and see the latest French films or Hollywood films and sit in cafes sipping good red wine. It really was the Paris of the Middle East, and
it became a very different place, alas, and then ultimately became the place where Bob Ames died in that truck bombing at the U.S. Embassy in 1983. Many years to cover between those dates, though, between 1967 and 1983. We'll come back and talk more with Kai Bird about The Good Spy, the life and death of Robert Ames, and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kai Bird, who shared a Pulitzer Prize for his book about J. Robert Oppenheimer in 2006 with Martin Sherwin. His latest book is called The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. Robert Ames, the CIA operative who died at the embassy bombing in Beirut in 1983 while pushing for peace in the Middle East, which obviously still eludes us. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. If you have some thoughts, comments, or questions about Robert Ames and the work he was doing, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. As many CIA operatives as you talk to, Kai Bird, I wonder if you got much insight into the process of cultivating sources. It sounds similar to what journalists do, but it sounds like that Robert Ames liked people enough to actually make friends out of his sources. He would reach out to people and get to know them.
Yeah, exactly. No, there is a great deal of similarity between what a journalist does and what a spy does and what a historian biographer does in talking to ex-spies. You try to, empathize with your subject and get them to talk and reveal their motivations and desires and their backstories. And Ames was just very good at that.
So again, let's talk about the view of the time in which Robert Ames was operating. After the Arab-Israeli War in 1967, he was making contacts with the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. Got to remember, this is I don't want to say middle-of-the-road sort of entity now, but it was very much not something that the United States would deal with at all back then, correct?
Right, right. No, and, Henry Kissinger had banned any contacts, but Ames thought this was something that should be done, that there should be some kind of back channel between the Americans and the Palestinians, and he formed a friendship with a young Lebanese businessman named Mustafa Zain, who was a friend of Ali Hassan Salameh, the PLO intelligence chief. And so Ames asked Mustafa to set up a meeting. And initially they met in a very clandestine way at a cafe in West Beirut. And then they had a series of meetings in CIA safe houses. And this relationship between Ames and Salameh became very important, both to the security of the U.S. Embassy, because the PLO began actually to provide security for the embassy, and this became important as the Lebanese civil war broke out. But also it was important to just have a channel of communication where Ames was trying to encourage the PLO to put down the gun and start talking about a political compromise with the Israelis, a two-state solution. And where the PLO, of course, it was a two-way street, where Salameh was trying to persuade Ames to, recognize the Palestinian the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and to recognize their legitimate rights as a people. So it was a two-way street, and it was, I think, by all accounts, sort of the beginning of the Oslo peace process.
From the research you've done, did you get much of a sense, Kai, for whether all of his work was officially sanctioned? I mean, was he pretty much given a free hand to do what he did? Was he ever snapped back to toe a line, don't talk to these guys, anything along those lines?
Well, he initially did this on his own in terms of the first meeting, but within 6 weeks he apprised his top boss, Richard Helms, the director of the CIA, who gave him the green light. You know, he told him this is to go ahead and to cultivate this source in the PLO, precisely because the American government didn't have any other official contacts. So yes, it was known. But I learned also from my interviews that Ames was criticized inside the agency for actually not going far enough, not taking the next step in terms of actually formally recruiting Ali Hassan Salameh. You know, that's sort of what spies do. What a clandestine CIA officer is supposed to do is to get a foreign national to sign a contract and to accept money in exchange for information. Well, Ames quickly realized that Ali Hassan was not someone who was going to sign a contract or take any money. And he got criticized by some of his colleagues who said, you know, he never closed the deal. But Ames didn't think it was necessary. He thought that this relationship with Salameh was far more important than having the man on the payroll as such.
It sounds like he was more in tune with what local customs were anyway. I mean, there's more of a handshake sort of agreement in the Middle East, it would seem, than this American view of, like, you know, get it on paper, get it signed.
Right. Exactly.
There's a sense of Bob Ames staying the course, believing that something good can come of his efforts in trying to promote peace between Israel and the Palestinians. But other events around them, like the Olympic murders in 1972, continually force backward steps. I mean, what did his family and friends tell you about his ability to stay on task, if not out-and-out optimistic?
Well, he did have sort of a Jimmy Stewart American optimistic outlook. He was a very positive fellow. But you're right, the Middle East is a dangerous and complicated piece of territory. And when the Munich tragedy happened, when 11 Israeli Olympic athletes were tragically killed and murdered in Munich by the Black September, sort of a shadowy wing of the PLO, this really set back Ames personally, but also he wasn't sure that he could continue his relationship with Ali Hassan Salameh. And he didn't pursue the relationship after that until he could convince himself that Ali Hassan had not been personally involved. But this was, you know, one of my sources said, when talking about this business of intelligence, he says, you know, our job is to deal with bad guys, and sometimes that means you have to sup with the devil, and you do so with a very long spoon. Huh. Well, in the case of Bob Ames and his relationship with Salameh, he was supping with the devil with a very short spoon. He literally was going over to see the man in his apartment. He would sit down and have dinner with him and his wife and his two children. He really got to know him very well and turned it into a real friendship. So it's a complicated business.
It really is. Now, at some point, he was taken out of Beirut before he returned. Is that right?
Yes. He was posted back to, well, he had posts all over the Middle East, but eventually in the late 70s, he's returned to Washington to the headquarters of the CIA, where he rose rather rapidly to become a senior officer and eventually a briefer for the president himself.
Despite the Jimmy Stewart references, I gather he could be fairly hard on some of the people who worked for him.
Yeah, he was, you know, he was a demanding boss and impatient with the bureaucracy as such. he was rather a refreshing personality in that way.
Hmm. Is it, in your own personal estimation, you were like 12 and 13 years old when he was your next door neighbor in Dahran, wasn't it?
Right.
It's hard to sort of put adult thoughts onto what was an adolescent mind at the time, but do you remember much about him in an adult sort of context? What kind of person you thought he was? I mean, thinking about him based on what you know now?
Well, my primary memory of him is watching him play basketball, and he was just damn good at that sport. He had, you know, been on the LaSalle College national basketball team that won the National Collegiate Championship in 1954. So he's very good, but he would play basketball with the Marine contingent. You know, there's Marine guards at every consulate compound. And so you would often, I'd see him out on the basketball court. And he was just a very, he didn't play the game aggressively. He was, you know, he played it for fun at that point. And he was just a nice guy.
So what was it that ultimately brought Bob Ames back to Beirut?
Well, by 1982, he was, as I say, sort of very high up in the agency. He was in charge of all analytical reports for the Middle East for the agency, and he was the chief briefer for the president. But in 82, he hadn't been back to Beirut in almost 5 years, and he decided that he should pay a visit. And initially, he was going to first visit Tel Aviv and then go to Beirut. And at the last minute, he changed his itinerary and went to Beirut first and arrived on a Sunday morning and had dinner with the station, the CIA station chief, and all of his officers that evening. And the next morning, walked into the American embassy, and about 1:04 p.m., a truck bomb rolled in and destroyed the embassy, killing 17 Americans and 46 Lebanese, and just virtually destroying the embassy and wiping out, in fact, the entire CIA station. 8 CIA officers in total died that day.
So only the change in his itinerary had him in Beirut at that time.
Yeah, exactly. It was just an accident of fate. And it was a mystery for many years about who did this truck bomb, but yeah, I did a lot of good detective work and pieced together what I think is very credible evidence pointing to not Hezbollah, which is what most journalists have thought over the years, but Hezbollah, this Lebanese militia and political party in Lebanon, didn't actually exist in 1980. So, but there were elements of it that were beginning to form, and they had an alliance and were being trained by members, intelligence officers from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, who had been stationed in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon in 1982 in the wake of the Israeli invasion. And I actually name in my book, The Good Spy, the officer who was in charge of those Iranian soldiers in the Bekaa Valley, and the intelligence officer who I think was the mastermind of the truck bomb attack, a man named Ali Reza Asghari. Now, the shocking to me news is that Asghari actually rose up to, had a long career in Iran as an intelligence officer in the Revolutionary Corps, but also he became deputy defense minister. And then in 2007, he had a falling out with the Iranian regime, and he defected to the West. And at some point, he was debriefed in a CIA safe house in Virginia. And he may be living happily in this country under an assumed name, provided, you know, essentially protection by our government, which is, I think, a shocking and tragically ironic development.
So the person who ordered the bombing of the embassy in Beirut, Lebanon, is living in our protection now, potentially in this country.
Yeah. Apparently so. We don't know exactly where he is. The CIA has denied, formally after my book came out last month, they formally issued a statement saying that they categorically denied that they had anything to do with, quote, arranging the defection of Asghari. But as I relate in my book, Asghari arranged his own defection. So this is sort of a non-denial denial.
Right.
And, you know, he may be in America. I certainly believe he was at some point debriefed by the CIA. But he may also be in asylum someplace in Europe or Israel, but he defected from Iran and came with a laptop filled with intelligence, apparently, about the Iranian nuclear program. And, you know, in the shadowy world of intelligence, this kind of deal is often made with bad guys.
Yeah.
It's just in this instance, it was a deal with a man who had the blood of 8 CIA officers on his hand, including that of Robert Ames.
So, again, back to the beginning, and we're talking 10 years after after the bombing that killed Robert Ames, still a big hope at that point that peace was possible in the Middle East. I mean, what has gone wrong that, that continues to keep Robert Ames' dream from coming true?
Well, we can have a long discussion about
right.
that.
In 35 seconds.
But briefly, right? in my view, what went wrong was that after the 1979 Camp David Accords negotiated by Jimmy Carter, and after the Oslo peace process got started and the treaty was signed in 93, both sides didn't perform on their promises. But primarily, Israel refused to stop building settlements. And this has been the major impediment. You know, we're now in another war in Gaza, and it's sad and disheartening. All these lives are being lost on both sides, over 1,000 Palestinians now and nearly 50 Israeli soldiers. And it's a complete waste because at the we're going to face yet another war in Gaza next year if we don't face the root of the problem, which is solving the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis and having a two-state solution.
Right. Well, so much more we could have talked about there, but that is the time we have. The book is called The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. Kai Bird wrote it. Kai, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You bet. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about groundwater protected as a public trust. We'll talk about the Reading Town Hall coming up on crime and business. And we'll talk about U.S. education standards versus Asia. That's all tomorrow on The Exchange. Our producer, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening and have a great day.